Mark Brewer as former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Jeff Timmer as former executive director of the Michigan Republicans. And this is a republic, if you can keep it, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer.
Welcome to A Republic If You Can Keep It. I'm Jeff Timmer. Later in the podcast, Mark Brewer and I will be joined by John Della Volpe, the director of polling at Harvard's Kennedy School Institute of Politics and author of Fight, How Gen Z is Channeling Their Fear and Passion to Save America.
And I'm Mark Brewer. As always, we begin with some legitimate political discourse here on the program about the politics of the week. So let me kick it off. Jeff, there's been some new developments, some new stories about what's going on with the Electoral College fraud, specifically the Michigan connection. What's going on?
Well, first, you know, since we're having this legitimate political discourse, does that mean we have to hit each other with flags and with fire extinguishers or anything like that? That seems to be what's classified as political, legitimate political discourse these days. The electoral, you know, the whole fraudulent elector thing keeps growing and news keeps coming out, and the breadth and depth of the conspiracy to subvert the 2020 election, the news just keeps becoming more and more astounding. Today, there's news reports about how Rudy Giuliani and his clown car full of, I guess we'll call them attorneys. They present themselves as attorneys. How they contacted the prosecutor, the prosecuting attorney in Antrim County, trying to convince him to seize the voting machines in that county. Not only to do that, which he has no, you know, legal standing to do, but then once he seizes the voting machines, to then turn them over to Rudy Giuliani, because, you know, that was somehow in his job description. The fact that they were clowns doesn't lessen the severity of the what appears to be serious crimes committed by Trump and those around him in the aftermath of the election leading up to January 6th. The effort to subvert the will of the people and to keep Trump in power, to seize power despite the fact he had lost the election. That's what's so astounding. The fact that they were clumsy and incompetent at doing it doesn't make it any less of a crime.
Yeah, there's another development on that front this week as well, that we now see that documents were being sent to various of the fake elector slates in the various states, fairly coordinated at the national level by the Republicans. And apparently Marion Sheridan, who I think is an officer of the Republican Party now and was one of the fake electors, was the conduit for that in Michigan. She refused to talk to the press about it this week. But again, as you indicate, the more we learn, the more we see that what happened in Michigan wasn't an accident. It was a part of a coordinated national effort to subvert the election. And we'll just have to see as more and more comes out. I'm sure the January 6th committee, when it issues its report and starts its public hearings, is going to have a lot more to say about all of this.
Well, now we have also growing kind of crazy on crazy violence within the Republican Party. Yesterday in Lansing, there was they called it a rally. I mean, it was like fives, maybe tens of people that gathered outside the Capitol, led by completely crazy clown former Senator Pat Kolbeck. I mean, who I think wears, you know, a tinfoil suit along with his tinfoil hat, showing up at the Capitol demanding a forensic audit again, you know, that term. But what I thought was kind of funny to watch the reports on was, you know, America's sweethearts, Matt and Michonne Maddock, the crazy Trumpists, showed up at this and were kind of booed out of the crowd because they're apparently not crazy enough. They're just kind of establishment crazy. And the real crazy crazies aren't satisfied with the establishment crazies like the Maddocks. And so now there's this kind of, we've talked about about this before, some of the division within the Republicans in Michigan, those who are the Trump conspiracy theorists versus those who are the Trump conspiracy theorists on crack. And that's kind of where we're at today. There's this this kind of civil war that's brewing within the party that is going to manifest itself in places that will have real world consequences for the Republicans this election year. And that most telling is going to be on April 23rd, when the Republicans have their endorsement convention for statewide offices.
Hey, Jeff, I want to ask you something more about the gubernatorial developments in your former party. It seems there's also an emerging split between the millionaire candidates, of which there seem to be several now, right? Rinky et al., and the grassroots candidates who are split in the way that you've described. What are the dynamics of that inside the Republican Party?
That's really hard to calculate at this point. There was the emergence of a new self-funding millionaire candidate over the last couple of weeks. This Perry Johnson, the motivational speaker, business quality guru, weird looking dude, who says he's going to spend tens of millions of dollars. And you can't discount something like that in a race where virtually no one else has any resources whatsoever. I've been watching kind of where the grassroots passion and support of the party is, and that has been with this Garrett Saldano, the chiropractor, gun-toting kook out of Kalamazoo, who had up until this last fundraising reporting period had been moving in the right direction, had been raising resources, but that seems to have petered out. He still has, I think, some numbers from his anti-unlock Michigan, COVID emergency powers efforts. And so he still has a big email list and still seems to have some boots on the ground. But there has been some, I think, significant movement on the grassroots side from Tudor Dixon, who's the former Republican commentator on, you know, some off-brand OAN and network out there, who has like no money whatsoever, but did a fundraiser last week at Mar-a-Lago with Donald Trump, has got the endorsement of two Republican members of the congressional delegation, Bill Huizenga and Lisa McClain, and so has made some movement there to separate her campaign from that of Garrett Saldano, and maybe be that Saldano was the 2021 Republican grassroots candidate to watch, but Dixon may be the 2022 grassroots candidate to watch in the year where it really matters.
Because from what I can tell, there doesn't seem to be a lot of fundraising going on. It looks like the big Republican donors, at least so far, are on the sidelines, Jeff, from what I can tell. Is that fair?
Yeah, because I mean, the donors are looking at this and thinking they don't have an A-list candidate. There's no good candidate in the field. There's no establishment kind of somebody with an elected base, somebody with a position of leadership within the business community or kind of the philanthropic community anywhere in the state. There's a bunch of C and D-list candidates. There's nobody who's willing to invest serious money in this race at this time because there's been nothing but clown campaigns. James Craig was supposed to be the guy that consolidated the Republicans. He has disappeared. He's going backwards in his fundraising. He's going backwards in his cash on hand, and he has failed to excite anybody ever on any day in the race so far. The auto dealer Kevin Rinky, has started the race under a cloud of accusations and old court cases about his blatant and frequent racism. I mean, he's like Joe Rogan running for the Republican nomination. Racism and misogyny galore. I mean, this guy would be a opposition research, you know, kind of just, you know, dream candidate. You know, Gretchen Whitmer would love to run against somebody like Kevin Rinke, who I think is going to be disqualified in every suburban woman out there that the media loves to pay attention to is going to vote against Kevin Rinke. The wild card, because nobody really seems to know this guy, is Perry Johnson, and whether or not he'll, his millions will connect to anything or not, or whether he's going to be the Sri Thanadar of the Republicans in 2022, the way that big spending Thanadar was in 2018 for the Democrats, spent a shit ton of money and got virtually no votes to show for it.
Jim, and you're a real experience in the grassroots of your former party. Are all these people going to be able to get enough petition signatures? I mean, it's not a small amount. You got to get at least 15,000 valid signatures. Is there going to be enough grassroots energy and or money behind, what are there, 8 to 10 candidates now to qualify for the ballot? Is that going to thin the field a little bit?
It could, I mean, because right now I think there's like 13 or 14 declared candidates. I don't think there's anywhere near that number that's going to get onto the ballot. But I would think all these candidates that we've talked about today, Rinke and Johnson and Dixon and Saldano, have the money. Well, Saldano's already
submitted his petition.
All the rest of them, even though there's Craig and Dixon haven't raised, you know, barely enough to run a state legislative campaign, let alone a serious gubernatorial campaign, they do have the money to pay for the signatures if they need to. So getting the it's not that high of a hurdle to overcome. They do have, if they could pay for those signatures. The other candidates, you know, Ryan Kelly or all these other names I've never bothered to learn because they don't matter. No, none of them are going to get onto the ballot.
Right. Well, speaking of paid signatures, let's talk about petition drives. I had a chance to look at the agenda for Friday's Board of Canvassers meeting. There are 10 petitions on the agenda. I've been telling people all day that Friday's meeting of the Board of Canvassers is the last helicopter out of Saigon. This is probably the last chance for petitions to get their summaries and their forms approved because the board doesn't meet again until late March. And so there's a real mad scramble by a lot of groups to get their summaries approved on Friday, to get their forms approved so they can circulate. This could be a real marathon meeting. They could be there for hours as they work their way through what looks like 6 or 7 could be contentious summaries of a variety of proposals. So we'll have to see how that all plays out too, because I think, again, you know, I've talked about this before, you know, between COVID and the cost of gathering signatures, I don't see how all these groups could possibly gather enough signatures. And statutory initiative petitions are due June 1. You know, they've only got a few months. Constitutional amendments, they've got till mid-July, July 11. But still, it's a huge hurdle in this climate. But everybody is scrambling to, you know, and seems to think they can get their favorite issue on the ballot. What do you make of this? I mean, you used to be on the Board of Canvassers. I don't think you ever encountered this kind of volume over 3 cycles, let alone 1. What's your take on what's going on out there? Why all this activity?
I would say any Yahoo can start a petition drive. Virtually none can finish it. It takes money and organization almost none of these people who've come forward have that. And so I think that most of these groups that are coming forward before the canvassers kind of launching their petition drives they have less chance to get on the ballot than those names I've never bothered to learn in the Republican gubernatorial race so far. They don't matter. They're not going to get onto the ballot. It doesn't matter whether their idea is a good one or a bad one. It's an irrelevant one because no one's going to know about it. No one's going to see their petitions, and it's not going to be before the voters or before the legislature this year. And so I think that there's what this shows to me is that there's a level of interest and a level of passion on both sides that's being exercised in some regard through the citizen initiative here, saying, "Well, we can submit this paperwork, we can go before the canvassers, we can say this, and voila!" You know, they think that somehow what happens then is magic, and that there's going to be lightning in a bottle, and there's going to be this, you know, signatures are going to fall from heaven, and the money to run a campaign in the fall is going to, you know, magically appear. It just doesn't happen that way. It's delusional. You know that from your years of work in this field. At the end of the day, I've lost track of the number. I don't even know how many are out there now, but we're what now? 12, 15, 18 potential ballot initiatives.
We're in the teens. There's no question about it. And I think about half of these are really, they don't intend to go on the ballot, right? The two voucher proposals from the DeVosses, unlock to the audit proposal, so-called secure MI vote. Their intention is to get our signatures and then have the legislature adopt their proposal. So then that's a real, you know, expansion of a tactic we've seen in the state for a long, long time. And actually one of the proposals on the progressive side of the aisle is to cut that option off. And I know there's been a lot of talk among progressives and Democrats and others in the state about, you know, that's not what the initiative process was intended to do. It's not supposed to just, you know, bypass the governor and let a minority of folks get the legislature to adopt their pet proposal. That we really should have direct to ballot once you get enough signatures. So we'll see if that proposal makes the ballot. If it doesn't this time, I think there will be interest in doing that in 2024 to try to put the initiative process back where it was intended to be over the last 100 years.
What I fear happening is a dilution of people's passion and energy, focus, and money. Democracy itself is on the ballot in 2022 and 2024 in places like Michigan. And anything that dilutes people's attention and ability from reelecting folks like Gretchen Whitmer or Jocelyn Benson or Dana Nessel, it takes away from the effort of protecting and saving American democracy. And so those proposals out there that come from good-meaning, pro-democratic with a small d groups to amend the Constitution to protect voting rights, that's an A-plus effort. Anything else that doesn't stand much of a chance of getting on the ballot just takes away from the focus, and I wish would go away.
Yeah, it's hard to recall prior to 218 when there was a voting rights proposal on the ballot, and now among the ones on Friday, there are four which relate to elections, two from the right side of the aisle, audit and the so-called secure my vote, and then two from the progressive side of the aisle. I mean, voting rights have now come to the ballot in a huge way, and that's something we never, never saw before. So this battle, Jeff, that you and I have been talking about for weeks now on this show is playing out across the spectrum. Candidates inside the parties, election administration, and now in the ballot proposal arena. You know, it's just a multi-front war to defend democracy in Michigan and nationwide.
The impact of Gen Z on future elections with John Della Volpe. After these messages on A Republic, if you can keep it.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
John Della Volpe is the director of polling at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics, where I went to school. Great school, if I can put in a plug for my alma mater. And he's also the author of Fight, How Gen Z is channeling their fear and passion to save America. The Washington Post referred to John as one of the world's leading authorities on global sentiment, opinion, and influence, especially among young Americans and in the age of digital and social media.
In 2008, John received an Eisenhower Fellowship, for which he traveled extensively throughout China, Hong Kong, and Korea, including a supervised day in North Korea studying millennials. In 2011, he was appointed to the U.S.-Russian Bilateral Presidential Commission on Media. His TV appearances include the most prestigious in all of politics, The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Well, John Della Volpe, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
The book that you've written, Fight, is a fascinating look at the rise of Gen Z and I guess maybe the tail end of the millennial generation in American politics, in the force that they've become since, I guess, over also coinciding with the rise of Trumpism in the country. And so, tell us, just kind of set the stage here for how you see this generation, their activism, and the impact they're going to have on American politics as we move into 2022 and through this decade.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, to be very blunt, Jeff, I don't think we have a Democratic president in the White House. I'm positive we don't have a Democratic Senate, if not for several million very engaged young members of Generation Z, and as you said, young millennials. To give you some sense, in the five battleground states that were key to this election, Donald Trump won voters over the age of 45. It was voters under the age of 30 who supported Biden by an average of 20 percentage points that were the kind of not just the energy, but literally the votes that were needed to put him over the edge in every one of those five states, from Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania.
What we've seen is Mark and I, through our history in election and partisan politics, has been this notion that occasionally we get younger voters who get energized around a candidate in an election year and a presidential year. But traditionally, in an off-year gubernatorial election, they fade back into the woodwork and don't play much of a role, and certainly aren't going to play an impactful role. I think we saw opposite of that in 2018. And, how do you see, what do you expect to see in 2022 when it comes to the participation of younger voters?
I think it's accurate. And in many ways, I can't necessarily blame campaigns and candidates who are always dealing with limited resources in terms of where they choose to spend those limited funds, and to not be, focusing on younger voters, often for the last 40 years, an unreliable group. But again, I think this has changed in 2018. We saw record participation in the midterm elections. We saw, again, record participation in the 2020 presidential election. However, when we take them for granted, we see participation kind of fall back. And I think that was the case, frankly, in the Commonwealth of Virginia in that governor's race. Youth participation was solid, but it wasn't nearly as significant. It could have been much more significant than it was. So I think what I've learned from 21 years of tracking and engaging with the younger voters is they need to be empowered. They need to be asked, just like every other part of our lives. And I think campaigns that understand that can understand the values that they care about, it's far more about values, frankly, than it is about transactional politics, the way we think about attracting other groups of voters. So campaigns that make young people a priority, not just the 2 weeks before the election, but throughout the entire cycle, encourage them to join the campaign, encourage people who join the campaign to give them the tools to kind of expand the franchise, so to speak. Those are the kind of campaigns I think that will benefit from this cohort of young people. let's be honest, we're dealing now with 40% of the electorate are between, you know, Gen Z and millennials. There are more of them than baby boomers, right? So it's an extraordinary significant part of the electorate. They still need to be kind of connected to and energized. One of the better examples, by the way, I think in 2020, wasn't Bernie Sanders, and it wasn't what we were able to do on the Biden general election. It was actually Ed Markey in Massachusetts in a primary against Joe Kennedy for the United States Senate. You know, it was Ed Markey who started that race a year out. We have a September primary in Massachusetts, and he was trailing. I talk in the book. He was trailing. Joe Kennedy was beating Ed Markey with young people the way that Barack Obama was beating Hillary Clinton in Iowa, like by 40 points. Okay. But what the Markey campaign did was they knew that the only way for them to win, they need to expand his traditional franchise of working class in Massachusetts progressive voters. And he was obviously, a primary sponsor of the Green New Deal in the Senate, and made that connection to AOC, progressive left, and really kind of empowered thousands and thousands of younger people to own a piece of his campaign and to organize and kind of really flip the table, frankly, on what a lot of folks thought was going to happen in that race. And not only did he win, but he also, I think the first or second line of his acceptance speech, you know, his victory speech was thanking the young people who played a critical role.
John, I'm really curious to ask. I mean, I'm party chair. Jeff and I have been active in our political parties for a long time. So we have this issue interest, this issue focus, which motivates these voters. What has it done to their party ID? I mean, are they identifying with one party or the other? Or is this based on issues and candidates, not party?
Younger people have always been resistant to labels, Mark, right? You know, as you know. And I found that although we've seen every issue, we measure 15 to 20 attitudinal issues about kind of the role of governments on trade, on immigration, on healthcare, on choice, et cetera. And on every one of those issues, especially over the last 10 years, the generation has been moving leftward every single year. Sometimes it's a point or two, sometimes it's 5 or 6 points, okay? So how they're thinking about issues, the role of government, they seek an active rigor, an active government. But that doesn't necessarily translate to how they think about party ID, okay? When I started the survey, millennials, it was noted that a plurality actually were self-identified independent, right? Not comfortable in either party. That's changed just a little bit. And now Democrats have a slight advantage, you know, to independents, kind of in the mid to high 30s, you know. But I don't talk about that too often because, frankly, to me, it's almost like a deterrent that Democrats see that and they take it for granted. Republicans see the Republican numbers and often they realize, well, we can't compete, you know, and you know, most of them are kind of independent. So I don't talk about this party that much because I think it's important that we think about younger people as like values voters first. And I think that's what they are, you know.
Got it. Oh, I don't disagree at all. I was just curious about whether it had an impact on party. So going to these voters and say, look, vote for me because I'm a progressive Democrat, is not as appealing as talking about the issues on which you are progressive. Is that right?
100%. Yeah. So like if you really break it down, right, to lawn signs, right, and billboards and literature and ads, you know, if you want to talk about being Democrat, great. But like, why are you a Democrat? Right. What does it mean to be a Democrat? What do I need to do to talk to young people to make them kind of engage with the Democratic Party and those core values? Mark, one of the biggest mistakes I think that folks make is that it's weird. They're somewhat intimidated, right? They think that like, oh, I have to be completely pure on every single issue. You know, I need to be supportive of federalizing marijuana. I've done hundreds of focus groups. I'm not sure that issue has ever come up. Right. But a lot of folks in Washington, D.C. think that that's an issue that's potentially blocking them from winning the youth vote. Another issue, incredibly important issue, is canceling student debt. It's an important issue. Okay. But it's not a zero sum game. You can have a conversation with a young person. If you're, if you personally believe that there's a better pathway to solving the debt crisis, the student debt crisis, you know, you can have a conversation. You shouldn't be intimidated. You should engage and understand again, what the values are kind of behind the politics and the policies that they support.
My theory is, I agree with you that telling them you're a Democrat or a progressive isn't enough to entice them to vote for you as a candidate or support your cause. But I just want to get your reaction. I think there are probably four words a candidate can say that could almost guarantee to turn off 70 or 80% of young voters. And those words are, I am a Republican. I think that the Republican Party, if you frame your candidacy within the context of that, that's an automatic turnoff for younger voters. That voters under 30, you know, that gonorrhea is more popular than the Republican Party.
It wasn't always so, Jeff. Right? It wasn't always so. I started the survey in 2000. Okay, take a look at the 2000 exit polls. It was a 50-50 nation, and younger people were essentially 50-50. Bush v. Gore. In fact, it were older Americans who are slightly more, quote, progressive, slightly more likely to support Gore in 2000. Okay. So it's not like it's this predetermined destiny. You're born, you're a young person, you know, you're in your teens or 20s, you're going to be a Democrat. It wasn't always the case. In fact, baby boomers for most of their lives, especially white baby boomers, have been more Republican than Democrat, right? And they've consistently held those affiliations. What we saw, frankly, was a combination of Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, kind of Katrina, financial crises, Obama, the rise of social media, him empowering people, which I think kind of created a generation of progressive folks who overwhelmingly supported Democrats, where I always felt that Mitt Romney had a legitimate opportunity in 2012, right? Because turnout was down and the midterms didn't go great in 2010. But his campaign, you know better than me, I just don't think they made the judgment. Again, even in that kind of campaign, the resources were not unlimited. It didn't feel like they were really making an effort to attract and peel away some potential voters. But know who did? Bernie Sanders did, right? And Occupy Wall Street. So there was this moment, I think 2010 to 2012, that Republicans, mainstream Republicans, you know, traditional conservative Republicans couldn't have an opportunity to engage this generation on issues like school choice, you know, on privatizing, you know, some aspects of government. Again, you know, with a goal and a vision of what the ultimate outcome would be, but there could be obviously a philosophical difference in terms of the right way to get there. Younger people were always interested in that kind of conversation. George Bush won 45% of the youth vote in 2004, and that's a big part of his victory. You know, John Kerry only got 55%. By the way, same number Hillary Clinton got in 2016. So I've been saying for many years, Democrats who win nationally, you need to hit that 60% mark with younger voters. The problem with Republicans is, as millennials aren't younger anymore, as they're in their 30s and 40s, they're more likely to vote. That threshold for Democrats can be lower than the 60%, because we now have two generations that are kind of inherently progressive, looking for Democrats, looking to engage. It's up to Democrats whether they kind of take it over the finish line or not, but it's getting to be a challenge. Great challenge every single day for the current version of the Republican Party, Jeff.
John, if I can, I'd want to explore a specific issue. And if you can't, I understand. And that's the issue of reproductive choice, abortion. I mean, it looks like the United States Supreme Court may be on the verge of throwing out Roe v. Wade, which these two generations have grown up under. They don't remember or ever experienced a time when abortion was completely illegal in many states. What does your research show about how that issue may play out with the group that you've been studying?
It's an important question, Mark. So I think a couple of things, one of which is millennials and also Gen Z, I have found to essentially hold the same attitudes about choice and reproductive rights as their parents and their grandparents, okay? So unlike same-sex marriage. Unlike, you know, legalizing marijuana, some of these other kind of cultural issues, where younger people ushered in generational change has created, openness to change those policies. Haven't seen that with this issue. Basically, it's a value that seems to almost be passed down from generation to generation. Okay, so haven't said that. One. The second thing is what I find with younger voters. I often ask them, what's your identity that you take into the voting booth? You're voting as a Democrat, as a young person, as a student, you know, as a person of color, you know, and more times than not, they tell me they're voting for someone other than themselves, someone who might be vulnerable, right? Trying to protect or give voice to someone. Maybe it was their great grandmother who couldn't have the right to vote, right? Or maybe it was for an immigrant, whatever that is, right? So this, I think, issue has the opportunity for younger people, again, to be energized and to fight for the rights and the opportunities that that they've had that others who follow them may not necessarily have, which were an important part of American society, honestly.
Well, it sounds like, though, what you're saying, John, I think it's great if it's true, that there's more of an altruism, a selflessness about these voters than earlier generations. Is that fair?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of back and forth in terms of, you know, the me generation, right? And is that something that, you know, that the baby boomers should have to carry, you know, or is that something that millennials should carry? I believe is that what makes me so inspired, as you said, is empathy, is the altruism. And when I ask them, like, you know, why they engage and why they're kind of fighting, and they tell me they're fighting for folks like themselves who need not just a job, but a side hustle or two, right, to make ends meet, right? Or the fighting for younger and older Americans who still in this country don't feel comfortable, feel under attack because of the color of skin or the religion and those sorts of things, right? So there is this profound sense of justice. And I think, to me, I think that was, you know, we could trace some of that back, frankly, to Occupy Wall Street and the current events that they witnessed in terms of just the sense of inequality that they were seeing manifested through conversations about capitalism that I think has kind of translated into other parts of their lives. And I just think they believe that everyone who works hard should have the same opportunity as you or I or they do. It's really not much more complicated than that.
One thing I'm curious about is the kind of the optimism or pessimism of the Gen Z and millennial generation. Many of economic forecasters, many people have said that these are the first generations that have an expectation or have a likelihood of not having a standard of living that was as good as their parents, the ability to own a house, their earning ability, that what they face in the future might be worse. Is the first generation of Americans that it isn't planning in assuming that their life is going to be better. How does that weigh into their participation, their outlook, how they look at shaping politics as they go forward?
Well, you know, we're seeing a part of that play out in real time with millennials, right? We know that they were, you know, they took more time to start families, you know, own homes, their careers compared to their parents and their grandparents. With Gen Z in particular, I think that they're redefining what it means to be successful. You know, I'm a member of Gen X, grew up, you know, essentially in high school in the 80s, you know, where we learned about Reaganism, we learned about Wall Street, you know, from Gordon Gekko, and it was all, so much of it was about the tangible benefits that were defining the American dream, the house, the car, the family, et cetera. For this generation, I think it's less about the stuff that they have, things you can buy, and more about the bonds that they make, right? It's about living in community. It's about having flexibility to live wherever you want to live with whoever you want to live, right? It's being comfortable in your work and feeling kind of productive and that you're doing something that you want to do and that you're passionate beyond just kind of the paycheck. For them, success is a house, a backyard, you know, someone that they love who is kind of close and connected to them. Those are repeatedly the kinds of stories and definitions I get when I ask them about what their version of the American dream is, you know, and why should we expect anything different? You know, this is a generation who saw tens of millions of their parents lose their homes. 80% of families lost 20% of their wealth during the Great Recession. You know, so they've never really had an opportunity to understand what financial stability kind of really could mean.
John, has that created a sense of insecurity, economic insecurity among them? Or, again, maybe what you're describing is, and you tell us that, you know, you can be satisfied with less than, right? All this materialism and the consumerism that American society pushes on all of us.
Yeah, I think that they are. The other thing, Mark, is they're just struggling with this anxiety and stress, right? It's like the anxiety of, if you're a younger high school person, figure out what you want to do upon graduation, right? Like a lot of folks probably in their heart of hearts don't understand that college may not be for them. And what happens is they end up taking a lot of loans, and a lot of debt, and they realize they'd rather be a chef, you know, or a welder or something that you don't need a four-year traditional degree to kind of achieve, right? That's real stressful, right? The other students, you know, who college is the right place for them, that's stressful too in terms of like what that process is. A lot of stress, a lot of anxiety. That's one of the kind of the connective tissues, I think, throughout this generation. And sadly, we're finding that is, you know, is significantly impacting their mental health. You know, we saw that recently the Surgeon General issued a report on the mental health status. And I've been tracking this well before COVID. You know, we have a majority of 18 to 29-year-olds who say they've had a significant bouts of anxiety, depression, hopelessness, fear over just in the last few weeks. You know, we saw that the suicide rate among younger people increased significantly when Zoomers were entering that age category. So they're trying, Mark, to balance their life and their expectations as much as they can. I think a big part of that is taking some of the pressure off of the financial dreams that may not be just as attainable as they were for the baby boomers, right? Who every single year when they were growing up, they saw kind of for most every year, like, the economy was expanding and opportunities were expanding, you know, the growth of the American middle class. It's one of the, you know, the greatest periods of growth in the history of the world that their parents and their grandparents were a part of thanks to the efforts of the greatest generation. So this is just a different time. And the reason that I want to write this book is for other older folks, not to diminish their accomplishments, not to say that their life was easy, just to put this into perspective that no one's life is easy, but this generation has had just a series of things that they needed to deal with. Angst, trauma has been caused by that. And while we had something that also connected us, this generation doesn't. Baby boomers had the moon landing. You know, we had 40 years ago, we had you know, the U.S. hockey team beating the Russians. You know, we had millennials had September 12th, the day after September 11th, right, when we came together. This generation has not had that yet. So they're trying to create it for themselves.
I tell you, the good news I take away from this, John, is that, yes, you know, and we shouldn't minimize the mental health issues, anything else you talked about, but these voters seem to be voting their hopes, not their fears. If I can borrow a cliched phrase, right? I mean, they seem, from what you've described, they go into that voting booth and, you know, they are altruistic. They are worried about others. And so it's not just a reflection on their lives and their troubles. It seems to me that kind of person, if they wouldn't do that, they'd be voting for Trump. right? Maybe voting for the dark side, for somebody who appeals to their resentments and who says you're a victim, et cetera, et cetera. These voters that you describe are kind of rising above these issues in their lives. And again, voting their hopes is what it sounds like to me.
It's an absolutely brilliant point. It's absolutely brilliant point. And I'll tell you where I think we can all collectively help them, right? Which is remind them that it takes the work of generation, that they've already accomplished so much that they don't fully appreciate. You know, when you look at even the number of laws that changed after Parkland, you know, local state laws have changed. Yes, you know, still gridlock on some of the big issues in Congress, of course. Same thing after George Floyd. So what's important, I think, you know, for people a little bit older like us who have that perspective, is to remind them of the success they've had and to help support them and to put this into context for them. That was lost by millennials. I think they wanted too much too quickly. Their expectations were too high during Obama. And I just think it's important that we continue to make progress every single day. You have to continue to fight. You have to engage, but you have to do it inside the system, also outside the system, continue to put pressure from outside the system, et cetera. But we also need to engage within the current system. That means voting every year, not just every 4 years, local, state, and clearly, you know, in the upcoming midterms in November.
Yeah, no, this, you know, as somebody who is, I'm a baby boomer, you know, getting up there, this sounds like a generation of voters I want to kind of hand the baton to. From what you've described, John, it really encourages me that this group sounds like, again, they've got a vision. There's some altruism there. I'm happy to pass the baton to them.
And what a great legacy that would be, wouldn't it, for Generation Boomers, right? To mentor and to pass a baton. And because, you know, boomers still have a lot of power, obviously, right? But what a great legacy if we could find a way to help that.
Yeah, I'm going to start calling you Boomer now.
Thanks, Jeff. I admit it, for good or for bad. Yeah. I got my Bobby Kennedy poster on my wall. Sorry.
There you go. There you go.
Did you have that on your wall at Harvard?
No. I was an undergrad at Harvard, John, so Jeff's teasing me a little bit here. Yeah.
So, love it.
But not during the Bobby Kennedy campaign. You're not that old.
No, not quite that old.
You know, you should come back to the IOP, Mark. We'd love, and the students, you'd be so energized by seeing the students. And what house were you in?
I was down at Mather House. I took some great courses in the Kennedy School of Government. Yeah, just really loved it.
Yeah, you should. By the way, the current chair, we have a student chair of my Harvard Public Opinion Project, it's called HPOP, is a Michigander. And we have, I think Michigan is very well represented in our little study group of 25 or so folks. So, yeah, we should definitely have you in.
Very good. Apologize to our listeners for the nostalgia here.
Well, and thanks. I can't believe how quickly this time has gone. But John Della Volpe, thank you for joining us. The subject is fascinating. Your book, Fight, is a fascinating subject. I encourage everybody to get it, to read it. Thank you for joining us this week.
It's great to be with you. Thanks, Jeff, and thanks, Mark, very much.
And with that, we come to the end of this week's podcast. Our great thanks to John Della Volpe for his insights into the next generation of voters.
If you'd like to be part of the conversation, send us an email, comments@arepublicpodcast.com.
And if the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. See you next week.
You can subscribe to A Republic if you can keep it on your favorite podcast app. A Republic if you can keep it is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.